From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Our Project Milwaukee series on the high rate of incarceration among black men in Milwaukee is now focusing on solutions. And two local women who have very personal ties to the system offer their ideas. Then a Milwaukee researcher tries to rein in the emotions surrounding concussions in sports.
Really, the story has raced out in front of the science. And that is unfortunate in any health science area, including concussion.
A woman downsizes her life into an 84-square-foot house, and a quilting program at Tachita Women's Prison in Fond du Lac offers the inmates more than sewing skills.
It teaches them the confidence that maybe they can do something that they've never done before. It teaches them the skill to keep at a project.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. As we wrap up our ongoing series, Project Milwaukee, Black Men in Prison, we conclude by looking at possible solutions to reduce Wisconsin's high rate of incarcerated black men. In the past few weeks, we've heard about efforts on the policy level to prevent incarceration to begin with and to help those formerly incarcerated men from returning to prison, like the organization we featured yesterday that's helping former inmates find jobs with local businesses. But for the two Milwaukee women we'll speak to next, the struggle to reduce the number of black men in Wisconsin prisons is far more personal. In their own ways, both Africa Imani and Barbara Robinson have lost sons. Imani's were killed by gunfire, and Robinson's are serving 100-year sentences. Yet both women feel the system, from the courts to corrections, is broken. They talked with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce about what they want to see changed. Imani tells her story first.
I had two sons that have been killed due to violence, July 29th of 99. And April 29th of 2000. So within 9 months, I've lost two of them to gun violence. For the last 14 years, I have been quite active in trying to pursue helping the detectives with bringing some kind of resolution to the case of my son, Ali. My other son, Kafi, was killed by a young man. I withhold his name, and he went to prison. I don't really know the history of his maybe police contact before, but I don't think it was great that to the point it would be impressive, you know. But he killed my son, apparently for no reason, shot him in the back 3 times with a sawed-off shotgun. I was quite angry and rightfully so, upset, hurt, and for the past 15 years, it's been a bit of a challenge. But a few years ago, I came to forgiveness for him, something that I had to pray for. So I've been working effectively to get him released. Every time he goes up for parole, he's denied. I just got a letter, I think it was Saturday in the mail, that he was denied again because he went up for parole this month. I don't understand why, because he has completed everything that they've asked him to do. He's gone beyond that. I have visited with him, and I think we have a good rapport. And I would like to see him released because I think that there are times when people commit crimes, and no, murder is a serious crime. And some people would not be like me to the point of wanting that perpetrator to be released. You know, some people, let's just lock him up and throw away the key. I view him as a young man who was in his early 20s who done a really stupid thing, even though it cost my son his life and our family a great deal of pain, which we still, you know, deal with. But, you know, you have to learn to forgive people.
Now, Barbara, you are also working for the release of three young men, your sons. Tell us your story.
Yes, all three of my sons are incarcerated, and that's a horror in itself. Because being raised here, not in Milwaukee, but in the suburbs, my boys actually came up through Catholic school and private schools and military school. I served 23 years in the military, came home, provided good for them, and they had everything they wanted. So upon graduation, I bought them a car, and my 18-year-old son was involved in an armed robbery, and his part in that was he was the driver of the vehicle with two of his friends. No one was seriously hurt. There was an off-duty police officer that was injured that night.
He was shot.
He was shot by one of the guys, my son's friend that was with him. It was three of them. And my son went off and left him and was charged with 122 years for a party to a crime and attempt homicide at the age of 18. My son, 18-year-old, had no prior records, no involvement with the police whatsoever. And I do believe that this is a very harsh punishment for someone. Then my 17-year-old son, who knew that his brother had not done anything wrong, he thought, well, I'll go down here and turn myself in and say that I did it. That way they will let his 18-year-old brother out. He would have a trial. And this is how his mind at the age of 17, he would have a trial and the people would see him and say, well, it wasn't him, and they would let him out. And he thought he would have done his brother justice by getting him out. Well, he was charged with 114 years for placing himself there. 114 years. And he, too, with no prior record. So I've got both boys serving over 100 years. And my thing is, my 18-year-old was wrong in the fact that he was the driver of his vehicle. But his time has been served. And I do think that it's going on 19 years now that a 122-year sentence was total. It's unjust. It's unjust. And I'm very hurt and upset with that because here it is, I raised them to always tell the truth and do the right thing. They did that. You know, they asked for forgiveness. That's one thing. But they also were not looking for any special favors. The 18-year-old was willing to do his time for the crime, but 122 years is ridiculous.
This is an issue that seems to come up time and time again throughout our series, this idea of, well, you know, these men have chosen to commit a crime. They should serve their sentence. Why should we care? This isn't a problem about mass incarceration. This is a problem of criminality.
We never know what we're going to do until it actually happens to you. Before this happened to my sons, I could have said, well, you know, yeah, any person that commits a crime deserves to be locked up. But I would never say for that long, even if the person that took a shot at me. I'm a cop, and I got shot at. Every last one of us have made some bad choices. We have all done something wrong. A lot of us just have not been caught. But we want people to forgive us. And we all have loved ones that may have been not only victims of crimes, but did some bad things themselves. We don't hold our loved ones to the same standard that we would like to hold people who we don't know. My sons are not hardcore criminals. They had not committed any other crime. They had jobs. I bet no one knew that. They both had a job. Both of them were working. But you don't hear that because the people only want to hear what is bad news. That's why all they want to hear. Oh, these boys were involved in a crime. Well, thank God no one was seriously hurt. I'm thankful for that. But the thing about it is they served their time and it's time for them to come home. That's justice. They realized they made a mistake. They made a bad choice in life, both of them, by whatever the choices were that they made. But they should not be held the rest of their life. Everyone deserves a second chance.
Criminals do choose to commit a crime. They do. For whatever reason, it is their choice. However, the punishment should fit the crime, not based on race, not based on where you come from, where you live. But that seems to be what happens, that it is, had it been, quote unquote, a white schoolboy, a good old American white boy, and he lived in Waukesha or Wauwatosa or Brookfield and committed the same crime, do you think he would have been sentenced to the same time? As her son, no. And 100 years is just ridiculous. You shouldn't even be sentenced nobody to know 100 years. That is just, it's out of place. There's no place for that in our society to want to keep somebody locked up. This goes back to rehabilitation. Where's the rehabilitation? You want to keep, you might as well just say life. So I think it's a matter of us having appropriate guidelines for the crime that is committed.
Why, Africa, do you look at the young man who killed your son and you say, at this point, he served his time for the crime that he committed. He deserves a chance to be released and to have a future.
No one deserves to be written off. I don't care who they are. You're still a human being. You know, I work with the Restorative Justice Program out of Madison. It's you know, it's a long process to get there, to be able to go see someone that you are the victim of or the family member of a victim. But when I sat down and I looked at him, and quite frankly, I can't even remember what he looked like at the trial when he was 25 or 26 years old, I see that he's losing his hair. He's going bald. His demeanor is comparing it to then, because at the time, yeah, I killed your son. Yeah, I did. And he was, you know, he was all cocky and everything. I'm like, yeah, lock him up and throw away the key. I want him to do every day of them 25 years he was sentenced to. Really, I did. But you come to a reality and you see somebody and you look into what they're doing and talking to their social worker, and you see that they have pretty much been a model inmate. They've done everything they've been asked to do. They've gone beyond that. They're not getting any trouble. They're not getting no major tickets. They really ain't getting no minor tickets in the past several years. So what is the point in keeping them locked up? There really is no point. It's just that the system want to keep him there, and I think the system is, you know, somebody come visit him and they'll spend money in the machines and this, that, and it should not be about profit making. He's been eligible for parole for many years, and they continue to deny him, deny him, deny him. Now, if they were giving me a reason why they're denying him, and it was a legitimate reason, I might be able to understand it. But from what I see and my talking to him, he's shown me that he's ready to come back to society. And I think he's learned from the mistake he made. You know, there can be no restitution to me and my family. You know, they talk about, well, he needs to pay restitution. What can you do? What can you give me? What can you give my 19, soon to be 19-year-old grandson now, which is my son's son? There's nothing you can give me. There's no amount of money that's going to make it better. I'd rather see you just come out and do better and be a father to your daughter, who's now well and grown. But the system is a messed up system.
So what do we need to do? What does the system need to do in order to start giving those second chances?
The disparities that we see in our system with our police force and within the sheriff's office is not really compatible with what's going on in our communities. I think, and I understand, you know, Ed Flynn, I have nothing against him. I understand that he has a job to do, but it's how you do that job. You know, I seen him on TV the other night, and I'm just damn sick of it, and this, this, and that. You hear that all the time. It gets to be rhetoric. The problem is, a young man addressed this the other week when we were there at the Centennial Hall. We don't have rec places, but yeah, we got the Boys and Girls Club. But we don't have activities to keep people off the street. This is why kids are hanging out in the street, because those who are interested in gangs, the gangs are going to be interested in them. But if we have avenues for these young girls and these young men, a place to go, to whatever stresses they're dealing with, they can go and they can relieve those stresses. It is a way to keep kids off the street. If we had more of these and rec places and people, adults who are going to be responsible, not only for your own children, but for other children in the neighborhood. When I say responsible, give them something good to do. But these things have to be funded. So either our city, our county, or the state needs to fund these things. And this is the issue. Because you see out here, okay, we don't have no roller skating rinks on the inside. We want to go roller skating, our kids want to, we got to go all the way out there to Brookfield. Movie theaters in the inner city, where are they at? They're all gone. So what is there positive for kids to do? So what do? They turn to the gangs. They turn to the street. They turn to prostitution. They turn to gun violence. They turn to all these things. So we have to find a way to help our community in order to help our children, because the next generation, it may not be a next generation.
And we're not going to help our children by calling them names.
Yes.
You hear Sheriff Clark, David Clark, and other people in they can get on TV and say, we got to get these thugs, these lowlifes, these dogs. That is not helping a person. They may have done some, committed some doggish acts or crimes, and I'm not by no means condoning it once again, but let's deal with them on an intellectual basis.
Exactly.
That you would like to be dealt with. Maybe if we stop calling them thugs, stop calling them dogs and treating them like that, maybe they will change.
Mm-hmm.
This problem in Wisconsin is not going to change because the people in authority have not yet changed. When they change, we will see a change. Until then, you're not going to see one.
Yeah. Where does that happen? At what point do we see that dehumanization happen?
I think that when you get to the point and you see people coming in, you lose that touch of humanity, because you begin to think, oh, everybody's just alike. Because of the profession you have chose to be in, our state of Wisconsin has become so disassociated with people. And they forget that they are human beings. And the only time it makes a difference is when it's you or your loved one. You look at everything totally different. You don't think about how bad the people you sentence, whether you've been a judge or the police officer, the person that you arrested and beat, the person that you stopped. This is the mentality of people. And I think what we have to do is try to remove the racism out of the equation. That's number one.
That's it.
Get people who wanting to be fair. And then we do have some in our system, but we have a lot more that aren't.
You're both working to get these men out of prison. Do you ever worry about if they do get out, when they do get out, what they're going to be facing at that point?
Actually, I do, because this young man, actually, I have a plan for him, and we've discussed this. We are going to help him in whatever way that we can, whether it's try to help him get a job or with housing or, you know, and help him if he needs some issues with psychiatric issues. But, you know, a person can be holding things inside because of what the prison system has done to them while they're there, that they might need to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist when they get out. We're willing to help him in every way that we can because, see, that's the thing. People coming out, they have to transition back into society. A person just can't come back out here, jump back into their old hood because life has changed. But if we don't have something in place for these people when they come out, they are going to go right back. We make it hard for ex-offenders. I hate to see people say on their application, offender. They are an ex-offender. They've committed a crime. They've done their time. They're an ex-offender. They're no longer an offender. Mm-hmm. So why can't I come out here and get a job? Why do I have difficulty even getting an ID? Why do I have difficulty even going so much as getting a cell phone, and now my PO got to track every call I make? Come on, you done your time. You might still be on paper, but you have done your time. So why do we make it difficult when they get out? This is why people go back.
Everybody in the community that has anything to say and aren't doing anything about it is just as guilty and just as wrong as the person, the inmate, that's coming out.
That's true.
I'm saying I'm here. I'm here for them. A lot of people who I have arrested and who are doing time, I'm on their visiting list. I go in. I take my time. I don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. But I sit. I listen. I talk. I'm not afraid of people. And because some people commit certain crimes, homicide, whatever, I'm still not afraid of these people. Like I said, a lot of your ministers hide behind the pulpit. Mm-hmm. A lot of your police officers hide behind their gun on their badge. I have always been the type of person, if I want to do anything, if I want to know anything, I'm going to approach that. And what am I going to do? Yes, I'm helping. I'm trying to get everybody that's eligible out of prison. What am I going to do? Right now I'm in the process of trying to buy a building. And it's going to house these people. So if no one wants to deal with them, send them to me. I'm going to buy this building that's going to house these prisoners that's coming out, these inmates that's coming out. I will help them transition back into society. Mm-hmm. And I want to make a change. I want these people out. I'm not afraid to deal with them. I want them out. Judges that sentence these guys intend for them to get out. So with Department of Corrections holding people in past their mandatory release or not letting them out because they don't have any place to go, they can come to me. Yeah. And I'm here to say that. They can come to me. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do.
Well, Barbara, Africa, thank you both so much for coming in and your stories.
Thank you so much.
Africa Imani of Milwaukee is working to get the man who killed her son released from prison. Barbara Robinson, also of Milwaukee, is advocating for the release of her three sons, two of whom are serving 100-plus-year sentences for armed robberies in which a police officer was shot. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. President Obama announced a joint NCAA Department of Defense concussion research initiative yesterday. The Medical College of Wisconsin is one of only three institutions leading that research. We'll talk with a head researcher when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report around 173,000 children are treated each year for sports-related traumatic brain injuries. In high school, the greatest numbers are in football and in girls' soccer, but they happen in nearly every sport. Well, yesterday at the White House Healthy Kids and Safe Sports Concussion Summit, President Obama announced a joint NCAA and Department of Defense concussion research initiative. The Medical College of Wisconsin will be one of three institutions leading this research, and MCW's efforts will be led by Dr. Michael McCray. McCray is neuropsychology consultant for the Green Bay Packers as well, and his work as director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin has earned him one of the Head Health Initiative grants through GE Healthcare and the NFL. We spoke with him back in March, and he told Lake Effect's Mitch Teich then how the questions we ask about concussion have changed and why.
If you go back 20 or 30 years, there really were no questions. There was very little attention paid to this topic or this injury at any competitive level. Then in the 90s, largely because several high-profile athletes came forward discussing their concerns about the potential effects of their repetitive concussion history, we started to really hone in on clinical investigations and better ways of managing concussion during the acute window. So, for instance, on the sports sideline or rink side, and then in the ensuing days following concussion as to how to best diagnose, evaluate, and manage an athlete affected by concussion, and then ultimately determining when it's safe for that athlete to return to play. If you look at the body of work over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been an incredible amount of science that has now given us best practice approach to managing the acute injury.
Is it oversimplifying things to say in the past we were taking a one-size-fits-all approach?
For the most part. And in the past, we managed concussion much like we did other injuries in that when an athlete told us that they had made a complete recovery, we gave them the green light. We now have more objective measures and ways of determining an athlete's level of recovery and readiness to return to play. Now, the new questions that are on the horizon really relate to the potential long-term effects of concussion, not confined to, for instance, the first several days after the injury.
You mentioned this idea of how we measure recovery. How do we now today, how are we able to quantify whether a recovery has taken place and whether it's a complete recovery?
Sure. Well, we keep in mind that athletes obviously are highly motivated to return to competition as quickly as they can after any sort of injury, including concussion. So it's always been thought that it might be problematic to rely solely on an athlete's self-report of their symptom recovery and making clinical decisions based on it.
I'm ready. Put me back in the game.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And we laugh that oftentimes that proclamation from the athlete may come as early as within minutes of the injury. But certainly it would come, for instance, on the following Thursday when the football game is the following night. What we've developed over the past two decades is an array of clinical measures that give us a more objective assessment of recovery. And those really fall into, I guess, multiple categories, including neurocognitive testing, balance testing, and other performance-based measures of recovery. Now, in most paradigms, we administer that battery of measures prior to the season and obtain a what we refer to as a baseline assessment on each individual athlete against which we can compare their performance after an injury and track their recovery back to their normal baseline and make decisions on recovery based on that approach.
You mentioned the high-profile injuries in the 90s as one of the catalysts for this kind of research to really get going. You know, there are still these high-profile injuries in professional sports in which sometimes athletes have sustained concussions that have caused them to lose entire seasons of play or even knock them out of sports entirely. How common is it for a concussion's effects to linger so long after the injury was sustained?
Uncommon. So if you look at the broad base of the literature in prospective studies over the past 20 years or more, you'll find that at all competitive levels, including youth and high school sports, somewhere in the neighborhood of 85 to 90% of athletes achieve a complete recovery based not only on what they're telling us in terms of their symptoms, but even on these performance-based measures of recovery in the order of roughly 7 to 10 days. Now, there's a large percentage of athletes that have a complete recovery in the order of 3 to 5 days, and about 10% of athletes have a recovery time that extends beyond 7 days. But across all studies, for instance, less than 2% of athletes have any elevation in their symptoms or lingering impairments that persist beyond, for example, 45 days. So as a sports parent, like I am, that's pretty good news.
I wonder if one of your missions in this work is to kind of rein in some of the emotion of this discussion. It gets a lot of ink, if you will.
Yes. And our observation in the past 3 years or so is that really the story has raced out in front of the science. And that is unfortunate in any health science area, including concussion. The reality is the risks to young athletes are relatively minor, particularly in the scenario of a single uncomplicated concussion. Now, when athletes sustain a concussion and either don't report it or they report it and they are prematurely returned to competition, the risk can be considerable. And it's our job to protect young athletes from those risks. But the science really has answered many of the critical questions, as I mentioned earlier, relevant to that early window. And just the same, the science will answer the questions about the potential long-term risks and hopefully ease some of the concern or even hysteria that has been raised in the public sector about this injury.
Well, Dr. Michael McRae, thank you so much for spending some time with us and shedding some more light on the issue of concussions.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Michael McRae is a professor of neurosurgery and neurology and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also a consultant to the Green Bay Packers and is doing research funded by a grant through the NFL and GE Healthcare's Head Health Initiative. He will also lead the MCW's efforts on the joint NCAA Department of Defense Concussion Research Initiative that was announced yesterday by President Obama. Many of us want to downsize and declutter our lives, but could you fit your life into an 84-square-foot house? We'll meet one woman who did when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. 10 years ago, Dee Williams was a busy professional and homeowner living in Portland, Oregon. When she had and then recovered from a near-death experience, Williams took stock. She scaled back and built, with help from her friends, an 84-square-foot house. Today, Williams helps others explore the idea of going small through a company she co-owns called Portland Alternative Dwellings. She's also written a book titled The Big Tiny, a Built-It-Myself memoir. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz caught up with Williams by phone recently while she took her book on the road. Williams described just how different life was before her big, tiny transformation.
This was 10 years ago. I lived in a big three-bedroom, 1,500-square-foot house in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, I was slaving away at my job. I worked full-time as a hazardous waste inspector and worked a lot to make my mortgage and pay my utility bills, and spent most of my time, it kind of shifted from being footloose and fancy free before I owned this big bungalow to being the kind of person that would stay home on the weekend to mow the grass and fix the roof and repaint the living room antique white. You know, I was spending all my time and money on this big house and then landed in the hospital. And all of a sudden, how I was spending my time didn't make sense anymore. I remember getting home from the hospital and I sitting in my living room and just looking around at the stuff that I had in my life. And it just didn't make sense anymore. And a couple weeks later, I read an article about a guy who had built a little house. And for some reason, it just clicked for me. It was like, I can get out from under my debt. I can all of a sudden, maybe I could work part-time at my job and do the things that I really wanted to do before, you know, I kicked the bucket.
So just to clarify, you were diagnosed with a heart condition. That was a blow.
It was really weird. You know, I was very active. I was a runner and a climber. You know, I'm one of those fidgety kind of people. Getting diagnosed with congestive heart failure, which had a really horrible prognosis of like 1 to 3 years, 1 to 5 years, all of a sudden it was like, I'm not going to be able to go running when I want to go running. It was scary. You know, it was very challenging to try to figure out how to make sense of things right after I got diagnosed.
Can you describe the process? What led ultimately to the construction of your tiny house?
Well, I read this article and I was like, I could do that. I could do it. And, I grew up building things. I studied architectural engineering. I loved operating power tools. I had a lot of friends who were carpenters. And so, you know, the idea of building a little house completely captivated my imagination. It was something that I thought I could do. And it was a great focus away from being fearful about my health and feeling kind of like a foreigner inside my own body. And it was awesome. It took me 3 months and $10,000. And at the other end of it, I had decided to sell my big house and move into this little tiny house and call it home.
So that being 84 square feet.
84 square feet, yeah. It's the size of my mom and dad's pantry.
So are you a very small person?
I
don't mean as a human. I don't mean at your spirit. I mean your physical persona.
Yeah, I'm 5'5", and I'm a tiny person. I built the house kind of proportionally to fit me, so the kitchen counters fit my body, and the house definitely was built around my body, but it's accommodating to my tallest, biggest friends.
I've read that you can now list your belongings on one sheet of paper. Describe freeing yourself of all of those possessions. Couldn't have been easy all the time.
Yeah, you know, the process of culling through my stuff in my big house was horrible. I mean, I don't want to gloss over the challenge. I mean, there's the easy stuff to get rid of, you know, your tchotchkes in the basement that you don't really look at anymore. But then there were the harder things that just couldn't fit. And an example for me was the artwork that I had up on the walls. You know, some of it was stuff that I had done. There was, you know, my friends are artists and, you know, just amazing pieces of art, and I didn't know what to do with it. So I ended up handing things off to friends with the condition that I could come visit it, you know. And it was grueling to go through and find good homes for things and to also let go. You know, I had a box of stuff up in the attic of, you know, old love letters and wedding announcement and things like that that really represented my past. And so giving myself permission to let go of my past was a part of me being able to kind of step forward into my new life.
So nuts and bolts, how do you handle water and electricity?
Well, I have a big 240-watt solar electric system that runs all my gadgets. So I'm off the grid. And then for water, I pull water from a nearby tap and jug it into the house. I have a composting toilet, and I shower either at work or at the gym or at my friend's house. And I think most people that I talk to, the shower is where the deal kind of falls apart. You know, and most of the folks that I know, there are lots and lots of people who are building tiny houses now. Similar to mine, but, you know, most of them have some sort of a water hookup so that they can kind of have a normal, you know, flushing toilet and shower.
Do you imagine any modifications in your future?
You know, as I've aged in place, the thing that has ended up being the challenge for me, I have a 7-foot ladder to get into the sleeping loft. And, you know, as I fell out of the loft a couple years ago and broke my butt. I essentially broke my sacrum. And, you know, I don't know if that ladder is going to work forever for me as I teeter into old age. Knock on wood, I hope I get to be old enough that the ladder doesn't work.
So that's really your primary focus, is getting up there aspect, not water or other modifications.
No, you know, over time, I mean, most of the world lives without water. And so, yes, sometimes it's inconvenient, and yes, sometimes I grouse about, like, whose idea was it to live without running water? I give myself a hard time for that. But those ideas are passing, because, you know, right up against my own grousing about what I don't have, I can very easily see that I have a lot more than most people in the world. Most people, you know, don't get to sit around inside that sense of gratitude, and or they bump into it every once in a while. And so I really do try, like when I'm feeling particularly bitter about not having running water, I really do try to spin it a little bit and get through it, and, you know, and then you wake up the next day and everything's fine.
I realize you have a story to tell, but when did the idea of, hey, I'm going to do a book, when did that start to form in your head?
You know, a couple years ago, a very good friend of mine, Tammy Strobel, was working on writing a book, and it looked like the writing process for her was something that she got a lot out of. And I was still, you know, trying to articulate what it was about my little house that was making me so happy. I mean, I felt satisfied with my life in a way that I hadn't when I lived in my big house. And I couldn't quite put my finger on why. And through the writing process and by, again, kind of playing anthropologist with myself and coming up, trying to chronicle what my day in and day out is like, I bumped into the idea that I think the reason I feel more satisfied is because I lean into my natural community and my neighbors differently than I used to. I mean, I really see, you know, I wake up in the morning, I have this big skylight over my bed, and from my first waking moment, I get invited outside visually to whatever it's doing outside, raining, snowing, which looks like, you know, a styrofoam cooler sitting on your window, or a beautiful sunny day. So you can't see that view every morning and not have it change you.
So do you imagine you might pass your first big tiny house on and build another, or are you sticking with this baby?
I'm sticking with this one, but I have definitely, you know, I got the bug while I was building mine. I love building, and I love designing. And so, you know, the fortunate thing is that I started this company called Portland Alternative Dwellings, and a lot of what we do is, you know, focus on the do-it-yourselfers out there. There are lots of people that want to take on building, or they want to take a look at simplifying their life somehow. So we offer workshops, we offer plans and books and stuff like that. And more than anything else, I think it's kind of a one-part how-to that we offer, and two parts, why not? You know, we really try to encourage people to examine, you know, what brings them joy, and do that in a way that, you know, is fun.
Would you have thought about the idea of sustainable living before your life changed, and has your definition for yourself changed?
Well, I mean, I studied, you know, my master's work was in environmental studies, so I think I've always been an outdoor person. And I've always called myself an environmentalist. But, you know, I was working so hard and on a certain track. You know, when you own a house, you kind of have to do certain things, like buy goopy, nasty stuff to seal the leak in the roof, and spend your time in certain ways that doesn't give you time and money to volunteer, you know, to help the local group trying to pull invasive ivy out of the watershed, you know. So I think I was an environmentalist, and I recycled, you know, and I rode my bike sometimes, you know. But deciding to build my little house and step away from, you know, my big house gave me an opportunity to live differently. So And by that, it wasn't just time and money. It was also just recognizing that I am a part of an amazing community. You know, I live in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I see that differently than I used to. And I see, you know, my community connections differently. I want the local food co-op to thrive, because I walk down there every other day because I don't have a big pantry. You know, it is my pantry. And so this sense of sustainability and what is sustainability has changed for me, in part because I've come to see how interrelated everything is, and I still have a lot of work to do on myself. You know, I'm flying all over the country for this book tour, and we all know that's not sustainable. And I, you know, humbly see, you know, there's still stuff that I can do different.
Dee Williams is co-owner of Portland Alternative Dwellings and the author of The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. She spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. You'll find images of Williams' 84-square-foot dwelling on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then take a road trip to the Wisconsin Museum of Quilt and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. An exhibit of quilts made by inmates at Fond du Lac's Tichita Correctional Institute is on display there, and we'll talk with the quilting program's founder. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. One of the things prison time is supposed to do for inmates is help them become better citizens, to correct antisocial behavior so that once they return to their communities, they don't reoffend. From training programs to counseling, time behind bars can provide an opportunity for prisoners to gain skills that will help them adjust to life outside. Tichita Correctional Institute is Wisconsin's maximum and medium security facility for the state's incarcerated female offenders. And about 10 years ago, Maggie Shea, who lives in Fond du Lac and had been doing prison ministry at Tichita, began a quilting program there for the women. A devoted quilter herself, Maggie saw this as another way to give back. With the help of a number of other volunteers, Maggie began meeting and still meets with the inmates every Tuesday afternoon. The first quilting projects were simple, but the complexity has increased over the years, and now some of the quilts the women have made are quite detailed and beautiful. The Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg is showcasing some of those quilts in their current exhibit, From the Heart. I met Maggie and quilter and volunteer Kathy Huth there to talk about the project, and Maggie explained how it began.
When we got out there the first time, the women had some machines, and some of them had sewed. There were a few that had never even sewed before that we started working with. Working with small projects, started out doing table runners.
Who contacted you? How did this all come about?
I also do prison ministry with a Bible group out at Tichita, and one of the women in our Bible group liked to sew, and she was kind of working from the inside to find out if there was some way they could get some volunteers to come out and start to work with them, teaching them sewing.
And Kathy, how did you get involved?
Well, I worked in a couple of the quilt stores in Fond du Lac, and Maggie and some of the other quilters would come into the store, and our stores would donate fabric and materials, and she kept saying, we'd love to have you, you'd be great, and so I finally joined, and it's great.
When you first started working with the prisoners there, what were some of the biggest challenges facing you? Were women interested in the first place?
Well, first place, women were very interested. One of our biggest challenges was that experienced quilters use rotary cutters. And initially, we were not allowed to use rotary cutters in the prison. And then maybe it was after a couple years, they got two rotary cutters. We checked them out, and we turned them back in when we leave. But that was a big help when we could do some of the cutting for them.
And you never felt any kind of pushback from the prisoners? There were probably more women who wanted to join than you could accommodate?
I think whether or not they could participate depended on the sergeant in the dormitory where they were living. So we've had as many as 12 and as few as 5 or 6 quilters that we're working with at one time. You know, it changes.
Do you have like a fixed amount of time that you work with each group, or is it just sort of an ongoing thing?
Every Tuesday. We come in, and the sergeant kind of sets up the time. We come in, and then we have to leave when they are served their lunch. And so we are limited on our time there. So we come in at 9, and we're usually gone by 11, quarter after 11.
But there's no, like, okay, for 6 weeks, I'm going to work with this group, and then we have another group. It's just sort of a rolling admission kind of thing?
Exactly. They kind of – Harris Hall is where is where we work, and a lot of the women have been there a while, are wonderful women, have kind of earned the right to be in that program.
Are you ever afraid for your own safety?
I never have been, ever. They're wonderful women.
This is medium security, right? Is that correct?
Maximum.
It is maximum. So you're dealing with some people who've done some very mm-hmm. serious things, and you've never felt in any danger?
No, I've never felt in any danger. I think we know that the sergeant is right there within our view if we need to call her. I think the women that we are working with realize if they slipped up in any way, they would not be able to live in this hall, and they might get moved to a dormitory situation, which would not be as pleasant for them. So I think they're careful that
Yeah, they're motivated to keep on the narrow path. And so the dormitory that they're in and that you're working in is a little more open for, you know, I'm assuming they earn the right to be there from good behavior and that sort of thing?
Yes, and I believe it, and I don't know if it still is, but it was kind of a hospice area too for women that have been there for quite a while and that are maybe elderly. Am I right, Maggie?
I don't recall that it was a hospice unit, and it may have been before we were there. At one time when I first started, we did fix up a room for a hospice patient, but most of the women that live in Harris Hall have been out at Tichita for a long time.
Now, we're sitting in the middle of some of the quilts that this project, the women in this project, have made. What have been their reactions to you? Obviously, they're enjoying it. They want to do it. Have you gotten feedback that this has changed their lives in any way?
Oh, absolutely. I think the biggest change is they always seem to be astounded when we give them high praise. It's like, no one's ever told me before that I could accomplish this, that this is such a great thing that I'm doing. And they know that the things that they're making are going for others, are going for fundraisers to help people less fortunate.
And Kathy, you've had that same experience?
Yes. I mean, you know, they've had tough lives. A lot of them have had, you know, very tough lives. And so we love to see what they can accomplish. And they're just amazed with what they can accomplish. Giving back to the community is just wonderful for them. They ask what the organizations do if we work for Sigma, if we work for some of the other organizations, and they want to know what they do, who it benefits, and they're so enthused and excited about it.
What about the creativity? Because I'm looking at some of these quilts, and they're all incredibly different. Do they represent kind of the range of creativity that you come across with this group of women?
Yeah, and a lot of times it starts out very slow. They really do come in thinking that they can maybe just sew a seam or a couple of squares together. And then little by little, they look at what other quilters are doing, and we encourage them to try to do their own machine quilting or, well, try this pattern and see how it goes. And it's amazing. And they do all help each other, which, you know, they all share information. It's very good.
They have a very large stash of fabric that has all been donated. And there's a quilt in here that was made by a woman who was a deaf mute. And she was very creative and very picky about what fabric was going to go into her quilt. And if you maybe brought out one piece of fabric, and she'd shake her head. No, that wasn't going to work. She knew just what she wanted. And
which quilt is it?
It's the yellow one in
That's
the corner.
That's a beautiful quilt.
Yes.
And
yes.
You say was. Is she gone?
Yes, she's gone.
Okay.
She's home.
So some of the women do actually leave.
And some of them do.
And do they continue quilting? Do they stay in touch with you?
They don't stay in touch with us, but we kind of hear from other inmates that some of them are still quilting. Others don't have access to a machine, and so they're not able to quilt.
Right, and that hand quilting at this point is...
Right, yeah, and fabric, too. I mean, fabric is expensive, you know, and so, you know, that limits them also. We do actually encourage them to get involved when they do get out with the church group, because a lot of the church groups do have quilting programs and have machines available and fabric available. So we do encourage that. Going back, they do watch Fonz and Porter on TV, and they also watch Nancy's Notion show, Nancy Zeman. And so they will watch that on Saturdays, and they'll come in. We'll go in on Tuesdays, and they'll ask us about something that they saw on the show. Do you know how to do that? Can you teach us how to do that? So that's kind of fun.
Once in a while, somebody from the prison will bring in fabric maybe for a raincoat, and they're not quite sure how to sew on that fabric. So someone that works at the prison will look it up and Google it, bring them in the printed information to help them.
What do you think, you know, of all the kinds of programs that go on in prisons to help inmates rehabilitate and think about what they might be once they leave, what does quilting offer that other programs don't? What is it about this kind of art and craft that you think is special?
I think one of the things that's special is it teaches them the confidence that maybe they can do something that they've never done before. It teaches them the skill to keep at a project. You know, we're going to work on this project until we're finished and not start two or three or four other projects. like I myself do.
I think we all do.
Yeah.
I think we all do. I would agree the self-confidence that they receive from the praise and what they think they can't do and they can accomplish really has made a difference in their lives.
I would think also that it's the creative expression has something to do with it, too. It's not just a skill. You know, you're actually looking at fabric and color and pattern and expressing maybe something, as you were saying before, that they not only that they didn't think they could do, but wasn't even part of the plan in any way, shape, or form.
Right. I was telling Kathy earlier on when we first started, we gave them a challenge 1 year, and we probably had 10 quilters at that time. And we gave each one a quarter yard of the same fabric. And we gave them 6 weeks to do a project that was could not be any larger than 40 inches, whatever they wanted to do. And they could use any of the stashes, any of the fabrics in the stash, and combine colors. And they were not to let us see each week. When we came in on Tuesdays, they were to put it away. So at the end of the 6 weeks, we came in, and they had them all hung or displayed like the quilts are in this room, and we were to judge. And, of course, we didn't even know who had made what. And I was telling Kathy, one of the women made a dollhouse, and she used spools of thread as furniture, and she decorated the whole thing with her fabric. It was just really exciting to see.
Well, it's a fantastic project, and I want to thank both of you for coming down from Fond du Lac to talk to me today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Maggie Shea is a quilter and the founder of the Quilting Project at the Tachita Correctional Institute for Women in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Kathy Huth is a quilter and volunteer for the project. They both live in Fond du Lac. I spoke with them at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. A selection of quilts from the women of Tachita is part of a larger exhibition there called From the Heart. It's on display through June 22nd. There is more information on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect, with thanks to our production team of Mitch Teich, Stephanie Lecce, and Dan Harmon, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.